Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another AMP commentary. This time, we're going to talk about George Miller's The Road Warrior, or Mad Max 2, if you prefer.
In the future, cities will become deserts. Roads will become battlefields. And the hope of mankind will appear as a stranger. Alone against all odds. He may be the best chance we've got.
You want to get out of here? You talk to me.
Today we're being joined by friend of the show, consistent collaborator, always available in a pinch, the one and only cinematographer, filmmaker, editor, Todd Norris.
Thanks, guys. Thanks again for having me here. I always enjoy these. These are great. Yeah.
You told me this movie was spoiled for you by VHS.
That's true. Or, well, no. In fact, it was by the network television premiere of the movie is when I first saw it.
Oh, my God. That must have been chopped up to nothing.
It was awful. And
So to cue this up, as soon as the Warner Brothers logo fades out, pause it, and then we will hit play from that point on. So if you're all ready, if you've paused it, I'm going to give you a 1, 2, 3, go. 1, 2, 3, go. And Kennedy Miller should be rolling up here. There it is.
There it is.
We've got Gateweave on my old
transfer
of this.
I love it.
All right, and yours says The Road Warrior, and my Blu-ray says Mad Max 2. So that's interesting that they
decided. Which is what the title was everywhere else but United States.
Because in the United States, Mad Max wasn't a hit, but everywhere else it was.
That's right, exactly. And this is the first movie that I can think of, although we can't tell as we're watching these titles, that this is in a different aspect ratio. This is an old ratio, mm-hmm. And that's where it starts. Can you think of any other movie that shifted ratio like before this?
Before this?
Hmm. Yeah.
Oh, Superman. Superman the movie.
That's true.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
That's true. Very good. Yeah.
So that was very close, like right before. It was a couple years before this.
A couple years before. Yeah. This is 82 and that was 80.
Or 79.
79.
Yeah.
I'll be real quick about how VHS or, you know, television ruined the movie for me. This whole beginning, this prologue that we're going to be watching, I had no idea until I got the Laserdisc that there was an aspect ratio change. So when I first watched the Laserdisc, which was the first time I saw it widescreen, when it goes to scope, I about had a heart attack. It was amazing. But I'm like, I had no idea.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. That this shot right there of Max standing there contrapposto in the pose of a Michelangelo's David is pretty amazing.
Right.
It pretty much tells us what kind of that he's a hero.
So I always think, you know, it doesn't really matter to me how this movie works as a sequel to the first Mad Max, but I can't help but to try to think it through, like, exactly how does this, what we see in this prologue, connect to the previous movie, outside of what he directly says about Max later. But is this all to have happened before the last movie or between movies?
I think it's between movies.
That all of it just, like, it was chaos in the first movie, but more like... the way Gotham City is chaos. There's lots of crime and it's out of control.
Yeah.
But then all of this goes down. So he's just a lonely widow who's driving around and then all this happens.
I think so. I mean, again, it doesn't matter. The roads became a white line nightmare coming up here as if that happened after all of this. But I don't know. The world of Mad Max and the world of the Road Warrior are so different.
Yeah,
because they didn't have any money for Mad Max. And George Miller even said in an interview that he felt like he was making The Road Warrior as an act of atonement for Mad Max.
Right.
Because he had such a miserable time with Mad Max and didn't get to do all the things that he really wanted to do. And so he said he felt almost obligated to do it right.
Yeah, he apparently came to L.A. and took a lot of meetings after Mad Max and kind of felt like he didn't earn it. He was watching Mad Max sort of thinking, man, I could have done all this so much better. So instead of cashing in at Hollywood, he cashed in by doing it over again. Sort of, it's similar in a way, weirdly, to Evil Dead. You know, like you get this sequel, it's like almost a redo sequel in a weird way, where they didn't step completely away from the idea, but they expanded on it and created a little bit more, a fuller vision, if you will.
Yeah.
But
I've always found Mad Max to be kind of rough going. There's spots in it that I, especially all that stuff when he's with his wife, and it just goes on forever.
Here we go.
And from what I understand,
yeah.
So we shift aspect ratio, and if I understand correctly, we shift audio mix as well. It goes from mono to like Dolby. I think this is one of the first Dolby films in Australia, if I remember right, like surround sound. Films in Australia.
That doesn't help the score that Todd feels like was recorded in a cave, which I kind of like how it's
like
all smashed up and mono sounding and just kind of grungy, but I totally get what you're saying.
It is. It's weird. There's just a sort of reverb on it that Hollywood scores don't have, this kind of strange, you know, yeah.
You know what it reminds me of? In the first movie, it sounds a little bit like parts of the Monty Python and the Holy Grail score. Like,
it does.
It's got
that
kind of distant
music
sound, like library music, yeah.
Just, I mean, what to say about this movie? The editing and the cinematography, I mean, everything is just so incredible. And it's pure cinema because it's all visual and no dialogue and just having to learn about this world, but also being thrilled at the same time with the car chase right at the beginning. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So much of this stuff has long shadows and we get this sense that it was kind of, you know, late afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether some of it is also timed to give us that kind of golden look, but like that stuff there, that was clearly late afternoon.
Yeah. I remember listening to the commentary with Dean Semler, and you know, they just ran out of daylight all the time because they were just shooting and shooting and shooting all day long. And so I think a lot of this footage is actually really, you know, at the end of the day, because they just were running out of time and chasing the sun for this whole movie.
It looks beautiful though, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That gold. And some of these wide angle shots, the earth looks curved in the background.
You know,
it really just is epic feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, along with Steven Spielberg films in the 80s, I think as a teenager who wanted to make movies, I think I imprinted on the style of George Miller as well. You know, I really, just in terms of the wide-angle lenses and the camera movement, and it's just that sort of kinetic quality. It's a combination of, you know, kinetic, but also very formally composed. It's sort of Sergio Leone meets, you know, a more kinetic, like if Sergio Leone had directed car chase movies. So it's really, really cool.
He had never seen a Kurosawa movie when he made Mad Max, and then he saw a couple in between. And I think you can feel it a little bit. He saw Yojimbo.
Oh, yeah. He says flat out that Yojimbo, Seven Samurai were influences, and he went to the Joseph Campbell well as well. So that he kind of did a Lucas-y thing with this when he came to approaching the story.
I've seen enough movies that Dean Semler has been the cinematographer that you can recognize his style. About in the way that he shoots in sunlight. Something about like using a lot of shiny board reflectors for sort of kicker lights on people's over their shoulder, and then, you know, lots of soft front fill so that everything's very balanced. You know, there's not a lot of ugly blown out shots in the desert. Everything is very, very well filled in and sculpted with the lighting.
You know, right after this, he shot Razorback, and it was budget challenged. And they hired him because he knew all the locations. They basically went back to all the locations of Mad Max to shoot Razorback.
Yeah.
And especially the gyropilot, that tree, that area where the tree is. That's in Razorback.
Oh, cool. Here comes a John Carpenter-esque jump scare coming up. A little misdirect. Oh!
Four shots. I remember slowing it down and looking at it to see how many cuts there were to get that body out of the cab into the ground.
George Miller always has had that visual obsession with those googly eyes, you know, those like bulging eyes, and he'll have those little subliminal flash frames. I just wonder where that comes from.
You know, there's two of them, and both big kills. The one at the beginning with what's his name, the Knight Rider, and then the Toe Cutters deaths are both almost the same, where they're about to crash into something and they cut to that googly eye for just a second and then crash.
Well, and John Lithgow's eyes literally pop out of his head, you know, with the special effect in the Twilight Zone episode.
Right. You know,
there's
a
fade. John,
Okay.
Oh, well, we're going to talk about transitions in this movie.
See the shot with the car way on the left and the tree on the right. Again, to show you how TV just ruined this for me. Mm-hmm. On the TV version, there's no tree on the right. You know, like all the composition is blown on the pan and scan television version.
Yeah, so this is the area that they used in Razorback.
Mm.
And by the way, freezing cold, apparently. Every time I've ever watched this movie, you know, it looks hot to me. Apparently it was freezing the entire shoot.
Really?
Yeah.
It's crazy to think. There's a story about Vernon Wells' character, Wes, has his ass showing like through the whole movie, right? And apparently they called him like barometer bum or something like that because they knew if his ass got purple, it was time to go hide for a while. That's the story he told. I heard a great interview with him. I'll have a few tidbits from it. They interviewed him on the Projection Booth podcast. And
it's so funny because this doesn't look to me like winter light. But if I guess I would try to be.
Apparently,
objective.
The weather was. They chose this area because it didn't rain ever. And it rained when they shot. So it was like the first rain that had been in this area for years. It snowed a little bit even. And it was much, much colder than it should have been. So it was, of course, So it's like Terry Gilliam was shooting this movie or something. Like everything that could go wrong went wrong for them as far as the elements are concerned, but it didn't affect the production too much. I think they had to shut down for a little while because of the rain, but that's it. And here we get Bruce Spence, and this is what a face. What a physique this guy's got.
It was such a treat to hear these Australian accents because I had seen Mad Max in the theaters prior to this. Yeah. And, of course, it had been dubbed with really bad American accents all through it. Samuel Z. Arkoff insisted on it being dubbed.
Yeah.
Even Gibson, who was actually an American, got dubbed.
Yeah.
Like, his accent, hardly incomprehensible in Mad Max. Like, he's 100% clear when he's speaking. I don't understand that. I actually don't think the accents in Mad Max are that bad at all.
No, they're not.
I've seen much worse.
Bruce Spence has the best foot acting there. Those little inserts on his feet. Yeah. Little
those are not good apocalypse shoes. Those are poor choice. He needs to find something with a little better soul.
That's true.
A little better support.
Well, I'll tell you, if they did in fact shoot this when it was cold, i.e. more in winter time, it would make sense that the shadows are always long, now that you think about it, because, you know, and chasing daylight.
That is a great insert. You get so much mileage out of it.
Of course, a quick fella might lead you to his dog. This window too.
There's a dolly in here, isn't there? I think.
Yeah. Right.
No, there's not.
Well, it's just a little.
Now that I'm paying attention, it's going from cloudy to sunny to cloudy to sunny on all these shots.
Yeah.
The weather's changing in every shot.
But you're right. There is a lot of light poured onto everything, isn't there?
Mm.
It's really great. Colorful, vivid. So what kind of a transition are we going to have here, John?
Oh, I'm sure we got a wipe coming.
There we go.
Oh, yeah.
That's a very Star Wars-y. That is almost the exact same shot as the land speeder going across the...
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know I love a wipe. And this movie's got a lot of my favorite things. Wipes and people looking through binoculars and telescopes. And
dogs with guns.
This is just dark humor, man.
It's so great.
And he sees that bunny. That beat with the bunny is amazing. There's so much like silent filmmaking in this movie, like bits of Keaton-esque humor. You know, if Keaton would have made movies in the 70s and 80s, you know, there might have been a little bit more of a twisted take to him like that little comedy.
That was a definite Leone thing, starting on the insert of a foot and ending in the same shot on this massive panoramic reveal of their main set.
They love this shot. I mean, they get a lot of mileage out of this setup that they got here, especially when it gets into the evening. And it's beautiful. When they get to the evening, the lights come on and there's some fires built around. It's really lovely.
That's pretty real.
Another one of your point of view shots, looking through binoculars, John. You were telling me how much you love those kind of shots.
I love it so much, and it gives it. In this particular case, it kind of makes the world seem bigger in a way. If you get what I mean, it's like limits your vantage point, you know, by shrinking the frame down. But it also makes it feel like there's a lot more going on outside the frame by doing so. I don't know if that makes sense, but
it's also
a good way
to
kind of create more out of a shot, I think.
Yeah. It helps that it's like accurate, like just those little whip pants that the lenses. I don't know. I say that now, and I realize now it's a little different. But it looks like what you would probably really see through binoculars. You know, they're not cheating it with by moving closer. Some movies that are really lazy, you know, the binocular vision is clearly not correct.
But this is a long lens. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's that kind of jitter from the vibration and whip pans, it all looks pretty.
And, you know, that shot we just saw of Lord Humongous and then Wes comes up and talks to him. We get everything about their dynamic, the hierarchy of this gang from that little shot. You know, it's the one guy sitting higher up. The other guy clearly wants more action somehow. I want more action. Let's do more here. And the other one's calm, and that's what we're going to see from them as we go forward. I didn't realize until recently that Archer made me watch the Revenge of the Sith again recently, and I didn't realize Bruce Spence is in that movie as a Star Wars alien that I call corduroy face, in the grand tradition of calling Star Wars aliens what they look like.
Yeah.
He's just got lines on his face. It's like, yeah, I could see why you would cast him in as an alien. He's just got such a unique, so much. You could put a lot of makeup on him and get some mileage out of that face. That's for sure.
Here comes the Dinky D.
It's such a crazy, wild, wide angle. It's just amazing.
It's a great shot, too.
That is the best dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's my favorite movie dog.
Oh, really? He's a pretty good dog.
So in high school, my friends and I were really into Mad Max. So this is when Beyond Thunderdome had just come out. And that's what, you know, so I sort of retroactively saw Road Warrior. And we went to a sci-fi convention and we dressed up in, you know, Mad Max gear because we were 80s nerds. And to top off our cheesy Road Warrior leather costumes, we had cans of refried beans that we had then bought some Alpo dog food and put the Alpo label on, and we were wandering the halls of the convention eating the Alpo. You know? Oh,
I was Mad Max the Halloween after this, and I subbed in a Froster's lager can instead of the dog food.
Nice.
But I made myself a brace and everything for my
cool.
Life. I just remember being kind of shocked by how hard everybody is and how, just because of the lack of dialogue, how it just kind of presents you with this world and sets you into a free fall. And I know we look at it now and it doesn't seem shocking, but when this movie came out, the aesthetic about it, everything was just really bold and fresh.
Yeah, think of how many imitators this movie spawned. In the 80s, a lot, some of them, you know, like just drive-in and straight-to-video type things, but there were so many Road Warrior ripoffs.
And none of them got it.
No.
The combination of the fact that it's Australian. Look at that shot, Todd. That's an effect of the lens, right?
Yeah, that's just an extreme wide anamorphic lens.
But they love this shot. Like, look how long they hold on this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're getting so much going on, and I guess you want to convey that these guys are leaving, but I don't know. They held on that shot so long because they look at it and go, man, it's lovely.
Yeah, it's a weird combination of real-time slow cinema with some of these shots and then this rapid cutting that we get in other parts of the movie.
See, it's funny that...
And a fade to black, just a nice little vignette, you know? That's so interesting.
Yeah, that's like the third fade to black so far in the movie.
Mitch, you just mentioned how like hard the people are. The characters are in this movie. Is that what you meant? That they're just kind of hard around the edges. But the gyro captain, kind of isn't. He's like the one that's not right. He's kind of kind and understanding as the movie goes through.
Yeah, but right now he's still kind of a predator. Well, you know, he just happens to have the up. Max has the upper hand, but I think he'd slit Max's throat in a second if he could.
Well, I really don't know. I don't think so. And I think that the point I was trying to make was we just had this beat where he delicately wipes his mouth after he eats in this world. And I think that's telling you right out that he's not that kind of guy. I don't think he is. I mean, I don't think that kind of guy behaves the way he does later.
I think part of the fun is just that attempt to preserve pre-apocalyptic manners, you know, this sort of holding on to old behaviors that have no function in, you know, this.
Yeah, and he's the only one doing
society.
It.
Yeah, true.
So if he wouldn't slit your throat, would he sneak up behind you and bang you on the head?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe, okay.
He might do that. I don't think he's a brutal murderer. I don't even know if he would have actually pulled the trigger on that crossbow earlier.
Yeah.
He just had the upper hand for a minute. But yeah, I think there's got, you know, it makes sense that there'd be one inherently good guy among all these people.
There's this comical sadism that runs through their relationship that we're going to see one more example of it here with their choice of, I think this is when the viewing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Utensils come out. But it reminds me of Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, how Blondie treats Tuco.
That's very true. Yeah, there is a definite connection between those two relationships. And I think something critical that was missing from Beyond Thunderdome was this kind of odd couple relationship.
Yeah.
Even though it kind of disappears later on in this movie, but it's just so critical to making this movie work. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Of course,
this reminds me
of Leone too, you know.
It's
very Leone-esque. What's going to happen?
But from that joke, it goes to this kind of cruelty,
yeah,
which is really shocking.
Yeah. That expression right there says it all.
Mm-hmm. And then the fact that they show what he's seen and it doesn't flinch.
Yeah. You know? But John, I think you're right. You know, just based on these reactions and his behavior, the gyro captain has some amount of compassion and humanity, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, with Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, it really felt like just if just one of those kids in the second half of the movie would have had some kind of a, you know, some kind of a really interesting edge that would pair up with Max, it would have been great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I don't dislike Beyond Thunderdome. I know that a lot of people don't like it at all, but I have a soft spot for it.
Oh, I like it very much.
It's the, I mean, to me, it has that Amblin quality to it that I do like.
Yeah.
But that's also what kind of takes the edge off of it, maybe. Certainly seems like he was going for a Spielberg-y.
Right. The first half is definitely better. It's when it becomes the movie with the kids, it does get a little less interesting. Anyway, that's another movie.
Right. I actually think that I get, over the years, I've come to like that part of the movie more and more for some reason. I don't know why. Just every time I watch it, I'm like, you know, I used to hate that part of the movie. I used to not like that movie very much at all. And now I watch it now and I go, you know, it's my
favorite
Mad Max.
You're right.
Here,
I mean, the humanity on his face right there. Yep. He's really disturbed by that.
Yep. Yeah.
And then it cut to it, though.
Yeah.
It cut to that inventory shot like that. It's just really exploitive. Well,
this was always the weirdest reaction, you know, this smile.
Yeah.
Well, because he's going to, yeah. He's trying. I think a lot of these guys are really, really dumb, right? I think that's pretty obvious. But in that case, his only thought was, I'll distract him by smiling at him. Yeah. That was his big gambit, you know, and yeah. Max is really smart, so that's not going to work.
But that insert shot, the low angle up on Max was an example of the Dean Semler look, I think of. Was there, you know, blue sky, but then perfectly exposed face, you know, everything mm-hmm. is just filled in very well.
Well, you know, they saw that sky and they were like, oh my gosh, we got to use this.
Yeah.
It was so interesting with all the different clouds and streaks and everything.
Yeah.
Okay, now we get to the green part of the movie. And you can see it here a little bit. On the Blu-ray, you can really see how green that little hill is. And then as he gets into this compound, you'll notice a lot of the costuming's a little green tinted, or they'll have green scarves on. There's even bits of grass around the feral kid's hole. I think that's a nice touch that he's coming closer to something that resembles lush earth, something natural, something good.
Which I guess that idea was carried forth a lot more explicitly in Mad Max Fury Road, right? Where the whole idea of sort of water and vegetation and being part of the plot, actually.
Yeah, it's to me, it's interesting. I guess there was some, you know, just like there were in the United States in the late 70s, there were some major fuel crises in Australia in the late 70s and early 80s. So that's what sort of spawned this. But you would think it would make more sense for this movie to be about water, too. Mm-hmm. Like, it just seems like that's also lacking. Nobody seems to care about water in this movie at all. Like, it... Does anybody drink anything? Do they send him with water when he goes across? No, I don't think so. They even in Beyond Thunderdome, they send him. There's some water that he has to take when he goes trekking across the outback.
A lot of shoulder pads in this movie.
There were a lot of shoulder pads in the 80s.
Yeah, but specifically football shoulder pads. Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Just kidding.
Right.
American football shoulder pads, too.
Right.
Well, that's, I think that's right. Australian rules. They had...
I didn't know that. Australian rules wore pads. Okay.
Well, they clearly had some pads for some sport in Australia. I don't think they shipped these in. But
I like that this is handheld, you know, this sort of him coming into the compound.
And then that... If that's a point of view shot, it's locked down on a dolly.
Yeah,
that's really interesting.
I haven't seen this movie in a long time.
So this character's name is Papagayo.
Yeah.
You hear it a couple of times. It's almost like names don't really matter that much in this movie, though. If you're a fan of Mad Max, you kind of know the names, but you certainly don't need to know the names.
Yeah.
As you're watching the movie. And then some people don't have names. Like, her name is Warrior Woman. You know, that's her name.
Just always thought she was Foxy. But she
always kind of
Vulcan eyebrows.
In my mind, she was always supermodel warrior lady.
Yeah.
You know, like she was supposed to be that early 80s supermodel.
She's Ginger and the other girl's Marianne.
That's right.
Exactly.
And Papagallo's the professor.
I always thought he kind of looked like a blonde Mick Jagger.
Yeah, he does. He does look a little bit. We're definitely, if you're going to start doing Gilligan's Island comparisons. No. Is the feral kid Gilligan, maybe?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
This guy is great. This guy,
is amazing. And I love his new wave haircut that he's got there.
I like how he doesn't seem to care that much about the dog. He's well, those legs don't work anyway, so what do I care?
But it's interesting in editing how they revealed it, though, that you don't really realize that he's paralyzed until the dog attacks. It's a cool way of editing it.
Well, what's interesting about a lot of these characters that I didn't know until I was sort of researching for this is that Miller and company, I'm forgetting the name of the screenwriter, Terry Hayes.
Terry Hayes.
Brian Hannett. They didn't do a whole lot of character work. They just kind of wrote the script, and then Miller really put out a mandate to the actors to come up with their own backstory. And I think that a lot of the mechanic, I actually can't remember. I feel like I heard Miller say that the swing was kind of an idea that came along later, that he would be on that swing, that wasn't even originally what was supposed to be his character. The Warrior Woman was a man. The Golden Youth that's on Wes's motorcycle was a woman. Like, all these things kind of changed as they went along and went, hey, who cares? Let's cast whoever we want. And gender roles can swap. And then Vernon Wells talks a lot about writing a pretty extensive backstory for his character, Wes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very adamant about the fact that they were not a gay couple. He's very adamant about that him and the young
and the
boy.
Golden and the Golden Youth, they're not
a
gay couple.
More of a rescue. They raided a home and killed the family, but then when he saw the kid, he basically stole the kid and raised him as
a
son.
Sure they were, Vernon. Sure they were.
I mean, there is a mirroring of it in
with
Max and the feral kid, but...
Yeah.
These compositions are so great.
And here's the saddest bastards in the whole movie, these poor guys.
Yeah.
They spend the whole movie on this vehicle.
I want to, advance, say, watch when he headbutts the guy.
Uh-huh. Mm.
And if there's I think there's a flash on the frame. So
yeah,
whether I remember that correctly.
I think you're right. And I think Robert Rodriguez stole that gag for some of his stuff in the El Mariachi movies. There's some pigs down there at the bottom.
Yeah, it's foreshadowing of Babe movies.
That's right.
There'll be some penguins later. For
yeah.
Happy feet. Of course, this is where the movie really takes a turn to me. When he gives this announcement, it's like, man, this is such a...
The Ayatollah.
All of a sudden, it's kind of weirdly punk rock, and
it's bananas. It's like weird punk rock, Kenneth Anger fetishy thing. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. And then I can never get Schwarzenegger out of my mind with this guy, Lord Humongous. But Schwarzenegger wasn't a star yet when they made this movie, really. So, and this guy was a Swedish. He was like Mr. Sweden. So it's not even an Austrian or German accent. I've always just thought it sounded like Schwarzenegger, but. He was his own bodybuilder movie star.
And there's the one girl back there.
It says
like
puny
plan. From Rocky Horror.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Oh.
They're adamant that they did not kill a rabbit for that shot.
Well, good for them.
There was a plan to, and somebody said, please don't, and they figured out another way to do it.
Oh, I didn't see it.
I didn't see it either.
Interesting.
I think that might be our Zoom recording not playing the full frames. We're getting a little... I'm pretty sure
it's there, right?
Yeah.
And then that's I love that shot.
Yeah.
What is with his lack of awareness? Like, they just threw a boomerang. He should be on the lookout, man. He's clearly kind of dim-witted, I guess.
A kid's boomerang.
Yeah.
Because this guy clearly thinks it's a kid's boomerang.
Yeah. I remember freeze-framing this shot to see how they did it. And and it's like a fake hand, and the fingers are already cut, and they just knock him over on this shot. Oh,
it's a great reaction because you can almost see his face turning pale, like the sickness you would feel.
And everybody just gets such a laugh from it. It's just so cruel.
Including him. He's such a kiss-ass that even he laughs at that.
This is that, like, in those Leone movies where they all laugh to make sure that they don't make the main bad guy angrier, right?
Yeah.
Some of this is funny to me because we go through all of this drama with the gang here, and then when we cut back to our good guys, I always kind of chuckle because I'm like, they just stood there and watched all this crap go down. It took 3-4 minutes for them to get through this argument, you know, and they're just watching it like, oh, there's a lot of drama over there in that gang. He's got that Darth Vader head.
Yeah.
So did you guys know that he was originally, in the first draft, he was, what's his name, Goose, Jimmy Goose from the first movie?
No.
They were actually going to write him in as he was going to be more burned and everything. Because you never see the Goose character die in the first one. You just see him burned and then they never come back to him. So they were thinking about having him be the antagonist in this, and then Max would figure it out, but they dropped it pretty early on, which is probably for the best. Especially since they were going to have to market it to people that didn't see Mad Max.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't mean much to them.
I'm starting to have memories. I was in a TV class in high school, and it does occur to me now that we had a VHS of this movie because my friends and I would just play this movie over and over again. Because I know all this dialogue. Mm-hmm. Just walk away. I spare your lives.
Just walk away, and I'll spare your lives. Did the VHS have, say, Apocalypse Pow on the front of it, or was that just the first DVD release? Because that always cracked me up that they chose that.
Oh, the pull
Apocalypse
quote?
Apocalypse Pow. Yeah. I think it was Leonard Maltin.
That was from... Yeah, it was Jack Kroll, I think, in Newsweek, right?
Oh, maybe, I think that was the
title of that review, Apocalypse Pow.
It's just such a funny thing to put on the cover of your, like, the corniest pun.
I remember it just had that oversized Warner Brothers clamshell box for the longest time. With
the green ones.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's so
bad. I remember like one of my friends before we'd seen the movie saying... Because all these reviews were coming out, and everybody, the reviews were great, you know. And I just remember him kind of going, yeah, I guess we should go see it. Everybody's coming all over themselves over it. So we went to the movie, and he was quite impressed at the end of it. Because it kind of came out of nowhere. From the way that I perceived it, it kind of landed, and everybody went nuts over it, and away it went.
It's just an undeniable movie.
Like,
I don't know how anybody could not enjoy themselves watching this movie. You know, it's so kinetic, so it never stops moving. It's just pure entertainment, and it's so well done. And like I said, they don't do a whole lot to draw the characters, but you still care about the characters. Something in the performances. I don't know how they get. Even like I love that guy. You know, like why do I love that guy? I don't know why.
He's open to negotiation. Yeah.
He's like Patton or something, but he's a reasonable man.
He's the reasonable man.
Of course, the kid. The kid goes a long way. The dog goes a long way into pulling you into the story. This scene goes a long way to pulling you into the story.
Yeah, so we're really in Shane territory here, right?
Yeah. And I think that was deliberately.
And
exactly
Lone Wolf and Cub, a little bit of that.
Yep. I think Shane was, like, they've said that Shane was the idea here. I'm not sure if he'd never seen Kurosawa before. I don't know if he'd seen Lone Wolf and Cub.
Yeah, that's true. I think he said he had never seen a samurai movie before.
Of course, this is very very Leone, right? Music box, I guess you call it. Is it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, isn't there the music box and for a few dollars more?
Yeah, what
do you call
it? Watch. The watch with
yeah.
the
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Of course, if you are a fan of the first Mad Max, you realize that he lost a son. So
mm-hmm.
get a little bit of a moment, sequel moment there. I got one of the things I like about Papagayo, how he's characterized, is that he's a good leader. He seems like a competent leader, but he doesn't really have control of the group.
Yeah.
Like he's just, they have a good argument against him. You know, it's like there's not a clear cut leadership about him, but he's still, I get it. I get why he's in the position he's in, but they're also in a really bad spot here.
Yeah, I've always felt a little bit like the townspeople are the weakest link. Like, I mean, this. I always thought he was a whiner, Papagallo, and it's like,
yeah,
are they really worth saving? It's terrible to say, but it's like they're goofy. That's a goofy bunch of people, that's for sure.
Well, you come to like her, little top knot there. Come to like her because of her relationship with the gyro cup.
But, captain. You know, Max wants the gas, so he doesn't have to want to save him.
There you go. That little that little dolly in is
it's really nice.
Historic. Right. Oh, look at that magic hour shot and all this stuff.
So here we are. Lovely. Yeah, we've got stuff coming up. Look at that.
Oh, so good. And all being lit, you know, and just a little eye light on Mel Gibson's blue eyes.
Making the most of these two shots because of the light.
Mm-hmm. Right. But that's the thing, you know, as much as this world, of course, is disturbing and post-apocalyptic and depressing, the photography really makes it all beautiful. I mean, it's David Lean territory a little bit here, you know, with just this gorgeous, beautiful light.
I just love this. He's got the future of the world on his shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's so mythic. I just, I love it. And we're coming up on a shot. Here we've got, you know, lights just off camera, but we're going to come up on a shot here pretty quick where they are going to be really right on the edge. I bet they were sweating it out with dailies.
So did they put something on his feet to make him quieter? Because in that close-up, it wasn't really a close-up, but that shot where he walked into frame there, it looked like he had leather, almost like moccasins, covering his boots. And then they greased his
I don't know. But
knee brace.
What were we looking at there? What are we looking at here? I mean, this is, oh boy.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, on the Blu-ray, you can definitely see everything right here.
Well, this shot right here where he's coming up is, I mean, whatever it looks like on the Blu-ray isn't what it looked like in the movie theater.
Right. Yeah.
Because it was...
I remember I did
almost dark, just a blank black screen, you know.
When I watched it on the Blu-ray, it was the first time I'd ever really seen that guy's mask and what it was.
Hmm. I do remember Dean Semler on the commentary talking about how they, you know, they didn't have a lot of budget for a lot of lighting and that, yeah, they.
Yeah, I mean, look at this. This is bananas.
Yeah.
So here's another example of not too bright of a guy. He's pretty easily fooled here. I mean, he can't tell that sound is coming from 5 feet away, apparently. This is great. I love it. It's not like a bad, you know, it's not like bad storytelling. It's just these guys are dumb. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, I think what we have to make our list of influences, we have to keep Warner Brothers cartoons on the list as well.
You definitely get that overtly and Beyond Thunderdome. Kid's great. Yep, I can't tell what's happening.
This is like the,
the kid.
This is the shot, right, where we're going to tilt up and we're going to see the landscape behind him, right? Oh, no, I guess it's still a shot.
I wonder if that's morning or evening. That probably really is morning.
Yeah, this one, this has been timed differently, the version I'm watching versus probably the version that you guys are watching.
Hmm.
Now here we are. That's this shot's great, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what, he didn't know where to go? Like, this, it's an interesting shot. They took a moment to have him look quite confused. Is he looking for him? Is that what was happening there? He expected him to still be up there?
Maybe, yeah.
I guess so. Because his first, you know, his thought was, I'll carry these as far as to where I find him.
Yeah, then I'll get that guy to carry him.
I don't know. I feel almost dense just thinking of that now, but that's exactly what he was doing. I kind of love how the gyro captain kind of has a relationship with the dog. You know, outside, we had that first beat with the gun and the bone in the mouth. We have this moment where the dog is the one that fetches him. And then we'll have he has kind of a lengthy conversation with the dog here in a minute, yeah, relative to the rest of the conversations in this movie. Explains the delicacy of snake cooking.
It's not a healthy relationship, John. He needs to get out of the relationship.
It's not a healthy relationship, but he's trying.
Remember,
gyro captain's just looking for a partner. That's his entire motivation, is to find someone to be, you know,
he finally finds that little kid in Thunderdome, and we don't get to meet him hardly at all, which is a bummer.
Oh, they have a pretty big role in Thunderdome.
I've always wondered, is he supposed to be the same guy in Thunderdome? Is it?
Can't be, right?
I don't think so, yeah. I don't think it can be.
Now, why can't it be? Does he die? In this, he doesn't die.
Well, I mean, what do we think?
He goes off to some other place,
many years later,
right?
Kid. Well, he's the gyro captain's supposed to become the leader of the clan at the end of this movie, right? And then the kid becomes later. That's how the narration explains.
Yeah, it's his twin.
But of course, some character continuity doesn't matter in Mad Max that much, you know.
No.
Oh, this is great too. That's low. See, he's offended by dishonesty, even in an apocalyptic wasteland.
Yeah, that is what makes him interesting. He's holding over with this sort of sense of propriety and codes that no longer have any meaning. But
he has a flower
like
in
a
his
reverse
lapel.
Tuco, as yeah, well, because yeah. Tuco's got a pretty clear philosophy. Not as humanistic, but
did you guys? He has a flower in his lapel. I just noticed it for the first time.
Huh.
It's like a real dead yellow flower, but he's got a flower in his. He really is trying to uphold some kind of civility.
I'd forgotten there were so many fades in this movie. It's 1982 was the summer of fades to black with this and the thing.
The thing, yeah.
I think he did it in Mad Max too. It's just a Miller thing.
There were wipes in Mad Max as well.
This is a zoom. Check it out. We've got an actual zoom. Wow.
One and done.
Mm-hmm. There's that arrow in the side of the truck. Oh, that's right. That's from the... Sorry. Mm-hmm. That arrow was from the opening squabble.
Yeah, that rig.
Yeah. P- partners.
Back to this Land Speeder Show.
Yeah, the Land Speeder Show
story visually.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You don't need any dialogue.
No.
This movie does make you fall in love with CinemaScope. It really does. As much as they talk about how George Miller used the center of the frame in Fury Road, there was some video made about how central framing allowed for the quick cutting. But in this movie, he's really using the widescreen very dynamically. The edges of the frame and, you know. As I say that as we get this one-point like perspective shot. Like
suddenly it's a Wes Anderson shot of the truck.
It's the truck from Duel.
I know, that's the first thought I had too. Oh, dude, get out from under the car.
No, no, no.
This is great right here. Just nice shot there.
Yeah. These days it would all be CGI enhanced. Oh, ouch.
So those shots, those low angle shots of the gyro captain are done on some kind of a rig.
Yeah, he's on a rig.
But with a real sky behind him. Later we'll get what I think might be the only green screen shots in the movie. When he crashes later. But these shots are real. I mean, real-ish. Yeah.
The camera's always right where it needs to be. It's just so... I'm envious. And just think of the coordination as far as the stunts and the vehicles and the camera. And when you probably had a fairly low budget, just... These guys really had it on the ball.
It was John Ford shot right there.
So what was his... Max's plan was just to get in the truck and drive. Like, you would have thought he would have maybe come up with something else, considering that he really shouldn't be able to get through this at all. And you have a guy, you have some air power if you wanted. He could have coerced the gyro captain to help him out here without...
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just funny to me when you think about plans in movies, sometimes you don't want to think about it.
Oh, really it was a dud. There we go.
A little Benny Hill moment.
Yep. Spread the camera up a little bit.
You know it's funny if it's undercranked.
Yeah.
And this is a little, some of this looks like it's maybe 18 frames per second.
Yeah.
A little undercranked. Sure. There's a lot of undercranked stuff in this movie.
But George Miller said in an interview that kids are watching movies on VHS at 2 times, 3 times the speed, and they're able to just absorb this information. And that was part of what he said was inspiring him to just try to make it go as fast as he possibly could.
Huh. Ooh.
Yeah, you're super clear on the geography and the action of what just took place with, you know, with the guy accidentally firing the gun into the back of the other guy.
Yeah. Yeah, this was back in the 80s before shaky cam and, you know, that sort of indecipherable action scene. This probably was informed by Raiders of the Lost Ark as well, just that clarity of geography.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to wonder if you would have seen Raiders yet when they shot this. I wonder.
That's true. That's
true.
Well,
Raiders real was close. 80, right?
No, 81.
81.
No, this would have been real close.
Well, it was certainly a 1-2 punch in terms of Raiders coming out and then this coming out in terms of action movies. I just remember thinking, man, everything's just so fast. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, this might be where the white frame is on this headbutt.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bam.
There it is. That guy's sad story. It's got to add insult to injury for this gang that this people are hoarding gas and shooting them with it, basically.
Yeah, it's like say, some whatever they fuel the they're using. It's
where like they get just, the fuel for the flamethrower?
They have so much fuel that they can just shoot flames at us. No wonder they're mad at them.
Oh, now it's Captain Blood.
Mm-hmm. It is a bit of a pirate. This is a bit of a pirate movie.
Yeah.
Sequence, you know, the swinging over to the other ship and suddenly you're mm-hmm. in enemy territory.
Yeah, I think there's even some little Corn Goldy kind of moments in the score mm-hmm. during this stuff.
We got to burn these stuntmen.
Great shot.
A lot of shots where you don't have to see the helicopter actually flying through the air.
Yeah.
It's very cagey.
Yeah. Oh.
That's definitely also Errol Flynn-esque.
Mm-hmm. This would have been such a fun movie to edit, you know? Can you imagine being in the cutting room putting this together? This would be so great.
And of course, he's the belle of the ball. That's exactly mm-hmm. what he is looking for, is this kind of attention, you know? It's like, what? Whatever. Da, 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 da. Snarls at him.
It's all silent movie stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That little W.C. Fields, right? Getting annoyed by some kid. Sigh.
Possibly.
What a charmer. I love her smile at first. Is like, he clearly wins her over in the next, by the next scene.
I forgot that Papagallo got shot.
Perhaps the best, the funniest, definitely the funniest part of the movie.
Here we go.
That guy's the best. He's going to sell us some batteries here in about 3 years.
Radiator's cracked. I got a cracked water. You get the reference.
What was that guy's name? Jacko that sold the batteries? The Australian battery salesman?
Is that him?
Oh, yeah.
No, he just reminds you. Yeah, like, right. It's definitely what they were going for with him.
You got 12. Okay.
Okay.
That is so great.
And you get your props from the best warrior of the crew, right? That's always a good moment. You've won them over if she says thank you, right? She was the most skeptical. Probably the best warrior of them all.
And the best looking warrior of them all.
Oh, yeah. Man. And it's interesting that they don't do anything with that. Max is not going to be interested in that, nor is this movie. But
in that moment, the audience thinks, oh, mm-hmm. of course that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. We're just programmed.
A little, look like Belinda Carlisle there for a second. Another, some more magic hour. Oh yeah, this
and
is great.
Zoom. Yeah.
Oh, this is so great.
Oh yeah, this is where we get this crazy montage, right?
The montage is incredible. It's just
like the hellscape.
Yeah, and what's so cool about it is that it's not there to drive plot forward like typical Hollywood montage.
Mm-hmm.
It's just completely absorbing you know, the moment, or immersing you in the moment of this craziness.
Yeah.
It's really great.
It's weird because it's kind of violent and rousing and very loud, but it's also kind of a respite in the movie in a weird way. It's like, it's actually a breather, even though it's really loud, kind of rambunctious, crazy. And then Lord Humongous's arms are just like holding, it's very Schwarzeneggerian.
It looks like an old, but doesn't, with these crucifixes, doesn't it look like some old biblical epic too? Some sort of strange nod to something from the 50s.
And yeah, that's preaching. True. He's preaching.
And Planet of the Apes.
I wonder if Frank Miller took from this for the Dark Knight, you know, comics that he did in the mid-80s. It really reminds you of that. What is that gang called that, you know, I'm talking about? When Frank Miller took Batman Super Dark, and there was a gang like that where a guy stood up and preached kind of in a similar looking landscape. Sort of like preached that they were going to take control of the city and so on. Why I can't think of the name of that guy.
Sorry, I'm a Batman Year One guy myself.
It was pretty close to the same time. I'm talking about the Dark Knight Returns.
Who would have thought to take time for this? You know, her, and whether or not she wants to leave with him, and it's just, it's really surprising.
Like I said,
to move the story.
You got to inject some humanity in here and there. And really, everyone else is just about business, and it's nice to have this moment where people have actual feelings. And then I love that he gets it. He's like, okay. He gets it because it's what he's looking for, right? She has what he's looking for. And he says, oh, I get it. Okay. And then he ends up, you know, joining the family.
That was like a cut to black.
Mm-hmm.
For just an instant.
I really like that he just opens by saying, I don't have time for speeches, because I wish more movies would... take that cue. It's like nowadays it would be like, you know, I knew a guy once that and he would give you some sort of allegory for why you should drive the tanker.
Yeah, that was the whole thing about the Wild Bunch. It's like, this is the moment when William Holden should make a speech, and instead he just says, let's go.
So he likes the old guy too. He actually cracks a little grin there for the first time. I guess he is kind of giving the speech now.
Yeah.
But he has to. He didn't got to sell him.
Back when movies were blocked and dramatic scenes took place in single takes instead of broken up into close-ups.
So here, that's a little sequel moment. Just very few sequel moments in this movie, you know, where they really speak to the first movie at all, but there they did. Certainly lay out why Max is so closed off by bringing up his family. Get a little emotion out of him.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think you even really need to have seen the first movie to imagine, you know, something in this moment.
Yeah, any wayward warrior probably has some kind of a past, something that turned him this way. So, yeah. It's really just kind of within the mythology of this type of story already.
Something had to give him that Bride of Frankenstein streak in his
hair. It gets real, it's real distinct in the third one, right?
Yeah.
He's got almost like a Polly kind of Walnuts from the hairdo. Sopranos. Yeah. Another thing I always love is a good stowaway moment in a movie or television show. Whoa. Oh, okay. He's not a very good stowaway, but...
Yeah, I love the fact that they just said, you know, this kid can be wild and we'll still like him. Mm-hmm. We don't have to go for some kind of cutesy pie stuff.
Yeah, this moment really works.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no, like, tears or anything either. Like, you could have... They could have gone with a real puppy dog moment there, but they didn't. The kid's just like, oh, that sucks. Okay.
Yeah.
It was a right to left wipe, John.
Yeah.
It's the first
yeah.
one I think we've had. Everything else has been left to right. That was right to left.
They're all vertical, though, right, in this movie. I think that all of his wipes are vertical in this movie. He doesn't do any Lucas-style, like, craziness. Going to bottom to top or sideways or circles. Circle wipes.
What do you think a wipe means, Todd, in terms of like what does a wipe signify versus a cut or a fade, or why do you use a wipe?
Oh gosh, you're putting me on the spot. I don't know. I mean, you know, it I mean, certainly it usually means like a passage of time, sort of like how a dissolve does, but it sort of feels like the turn of a page. Like if you can't really turn a page on a screen, it's sort of a similar approach, but
I like that idea, a turning of a page. Yeah. So it, because I always think like, what? I love wipes, but what does it do to the movie that makes it different than a movie that doesn't have wipes? You know,
well,
and maybe that's
one,
it. It reduces it to this, not reduces it, but it suggests that there's something. Yeah, like a storybook.
I mean, to me, it's typically about energy, and in this movie, it's kind of front to back. He uses wipes very early in this movie and on through the whole film. And this movie never stops moving. In Mad Max, he doesn't really use them until the shit goes down, until the family's dead and he starts going on his revenge quest. Then it's signifying to the audience, okay, we're moving now. We're on a breakneck pace. The shit got real. That's what I've said this before, when I write them into a script, that's usually what I do that for. I put them in a place, okay, we're picking up the pace now. The story is now going to get a little quicker, and I want you to see that in your mind, you know, that it's the fact that it's an edit that's within the frame, you know, just makes a world of difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Obviously, you can cut, multiple cuts can create a lot of energy as well, but there's something about that wipe that's just, it's exciting. And people try to say that it's old-fashioned, and that drives me nuts.
What's
it's not
that?
Old-fashioned. There's nothing old-fashioned. Let's just get this out. There's nothing in movies that's old-fashioned. You can use whatever you want. Like, style is style. You can use it.
Right.
There's nothing that's like, oh, well, you can't. It's 2021. You can't use a wipe now. That's ridiculous. I hear people
say
that.
I agree with that totally. I'm more interested in what it is inviting the audience to consider, like, just in terms of the kind of movie it is. Like, I don't think that you can't use a wipe in all movies, but if you add a wipe to a particular movie, it will transform it into something else.
Did I mention this on, I can't remember if I mentioned this on the Bond podcast at some point, but one of the great wipe moments in the history of film is in the movie Destry Rides Again, right? Where Jimmy Stewart plays the lawman that doesn't carry a gun, right? Through the whole movie, he doesn't carry a gun. And then something goes down and it wipes to him walking into a room, grabbing a gun, turning around and leaving, and wipes out of the scene. And it's like, that just wouldn't have worked the same if it would have been cut. Like, it's something about that wipe that just tells you he's pissed now. He's not just picking up the gun, but there's something, I don't know, more kinetic about it. It's more cinematic than just the cut. And again, that is a movie from the 1930s. So people that call wipes old fashioned, sure, that's an example from a long time ago. But I just don't understand those kind of arguments.
Well, wipes had kind of gone out of fashion until Star Wars, right? I mean, if I remember correctly, that's sort of what brought it back in vogue.
I hate this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Why?
Why? Because
why
a
do
tough
people
movie.
Kill dogs?
It's a ruthless movie.
Well, I mean, you got to take something away from Max.
Yeah.
You know, in the first movie, it was the wife and kid. There's nothing else but the dog. Sad enough, but I just hate killing dogs.
Oh yeah, it's awful. There was a movie called Fresh that we played at the Fine Arts Theater when I worked there, and they kill a dog in that movie, and every screening somebody would walk out in that scene.
And they also kill a girl by shooting her in the throat and making her die slowly in that movie, but people don't walk out of that scene.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with Fresh. I love that movie, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, always the biggest mistake the villain makes.
Is there a little diffusion on these lenses, Todd? On that shot? That looks a little diffused.
Well, I remember the commentary. They're shooting this at the end of the day, and this lens is wide open at like f1. And so it's soft because it's wide open. So speaking of,
there was a wipe that was almost invisible.
Yeah,
I love it when the wipe goes with the person. Things like that. That's very Lucas-y too.
So wipes are opticals, you know. And here's another optical trick that is really interesting. It's very simple to do, you know, but the effect is perfect.
Was it double printing it with?
Yeah, pretty much. You just kind of scoot the same footage about 3 frames or 4 frames forward or back, and so you get this strobe-y effect.
It's almost like in the film noir when they get slipped a Mickey thing here that we're getting.
Totally.
It gives us an idea of what his disorientation is at this moment, and then we get this dreamy moment here.
And this is so great. This is the mythic, you know, rescue from above.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is the birds coming, the eagles come and rescue him, Lord of the Rings. And there's also something kind of weirdly Apocalypse Now about this shot, you know?
Yeah.
See, I think of MASH for a second, but I've been watching a lot of MASH lately, so.
But nah.
But I do think that this is where the Joseph Campbell stuff, you can really see it.
I love how he's leaning in saying, partner, and he's giving this big smile, and when we cut to Gibson, his eye is like bugged out, like really weirded out. Like, what is going on?
Look at the lens distortion, like how wide that lens must be.
Yeah. On the TV version, they turned this black and white, I guess because of the blood.
No.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Seriously? Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. That's
world?
Terrible. Now, this is the Apocalypse Now shot, right?
Yeah, clearly, there we go. Right? Saigon.
It's lit the same way.
I can hear the doors right now.
Yeah.
Somebody turn it off, please.
Wow, there was a dissolve on that shot, wasn't there?
There sure was, yeah.
Yeah.
Another one.
It's those quick dissolves like in Empire Strikes Back at the end Maybe the optical house gave him a deal. Maybe that's why they did all these.
You know, I'm trying to think of a movie.
Do one wipe, get 10 wipes free.
I'm trying to think of like a digital movie, you know, in the last few years that leans so heavily on optical transitions. Can you think of anything? And look the same as when you use an optical printer? Like, does the digital, can we get a digital wipe to look as cool as a film wipe?
I think you can.
Yeah.
I mean, it's back to Star Wars again, but Rian Johnson really went crazy in The Last Jedi with his transit. He had a lot of fun with Star Wars-y transitions, including there's the moment with Kylo Ren and Leia where they have the Empire Strikes Back quick dissolves back and forth.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I can't remember if Last Jedi's shot on film or not.
It is. Yes, it is. I think it is. Shot on film.
That's the only thing I can think of. You just don't see that much of that stuff these days.
I'm trying to think. I imagine maybe Edgar Wright has probably done some crazy transitions.
Yeah, there's a
transitions.
Yeah, you're probably right.
He's a cutter though. Like he really likes to use hard cuts, but in a very creative way.
Yeah.
He's much more about framing shots and cutting between shots than he is using optical.
Hmm.
I think there's some white.
I think. I mean,
that, though.
You're probably right. I've seen this movie so many times, I would think, I don't know if I have a feel for that or not, though.
Hmm. So Mel Gibson had to basically do an Australian accent that he had lost.
He kind of had one. No, he was born in America, but he grew up most of his life in Australia.
Yeah.
I don't know how old he was when they moved from New York, but...
Yeah, doesn't he have an accent in that? What's the movie you did before that? This was it, Tim, or
Tim.
The one with Piper Laurie?
Yeah.
There's Tim, and then Gallipoli after this.
Yeah, Gallipoli's got the accent.
Or before Gallipoli's before this too, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he doesn't have a thick accent at any point. Like it's never incomprehensible where you would have to overdub him. It's just so silly.
I love the bird in the...
The bird in the foreground. It's almost foreboding, right? So he stole this car. This is not his car. This was the villain, one of the villain's cars earlier, right? The Papagayo here is driving.
Mm.
I always thought it fit his character, but it also isn't his.
I believe those were both zooms, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Ah.
It's just so
on a leash.
But just think of the logistics of doing shots like that, where you had to get all the cars to hit their marks just right, and then the camera had to do a little boom up and a move over. You know, all these things just take precision and planning. It occurs to me Mad Max's hair at the beginning of Beyond Thunderdome is the same haircut as the feral kid.
It's the kid, yep. It's kind of hard not to think about the Lost Boys with that kid, too. Now I see the girl... chasing him. I'm like, oh, the Lost Boys just kind of stole that relationship, didn't they? Mm-hmm. And the kid kind of looks like the kid, too.
We're just watching the movie now.
Yeah, I always love these shots of him, how dark they are in the cab of the truck and compressed, the long lens. It's just...
So I've always been confused by that part because it seems to be telling us he got hit, but he did not get hit, right? Because there he is, he's fine. So I never understood that reaction shot.
Maybe he felt the bullet whiz by his head.
Maybe. It's just an awful big reaction.
Well, you know, John, he's an expressive guy.
Well, I get that, but I mean, in this moment of the movie, to cut to that is what I mean. Yeah. Like, what you should be telling me something big right now, not a near miss. These idiots. Obviously, this place is booby-trapped. Why would they leave it to you? Well, maybe they thought they took the deal. I don't know. So, from what I understand, this explosion required stopping air traffic.
Yeah.
And stopping mining operations at nearby mines for the period of time it took to set up the shot and have the explosion. There were some mines nearby, and they couldn't let the miners be in them when this explosion went down.
Oh, wow.
It was such a crazy explosion. The largest single explosion for a movie ever, I think.
And there's this moment right here, is it right here, where some debris comes pretty close to the camera.
Yeah.
And you can hear it. I missed it. It's a crazy explosion. And I guess the military assisted on the explosion, too. Apparently, they were very cooperative with movies, the Australian Army. They gave George Miller a rocket for the first movie to put in the car. I think it's Knight Rider's car at the beginning has a rocket in it. You can kind of see it when it crashes. Like, sure, we'll give you a rocket to put in a car. It's kind of crazy. So maybe it's lacrosse. Are they lacrosse shoulder pads? Is that what? Now that we see him wearing the lacrosse helmet, maybe that's what the shoulder pads are.
Could be. Jeez.
I like how casual Wes is right there. He's like leaning against the, like the.
It's like a hayride.
He's like, oh, just a cartoon like, character. That's the thing, is it's so funny and it's so brutal all at once, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like it won't quite let you completely be giddy because it'll turn around and then, you know,
yeah,
take somebody's head off. It's, and you're like, oh, geez, I can't completely laugh at it.
I mean, the George Miller, that's just George Miller's sensibility, right? Like when you think about the guitar player guy in Fury Road and you're like, what is that? That's, you're like laughing at the absurdity. Yeah, and then you look at him closely and you go, dear God, that's disturbing. Look at him. He's completely deformed and chained to a truck.
Yeah, I appreciate his love of the grotesque.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I think isn't this a moment too where, yeah, this is insanely painful concept here. I mean, dragging a vehicle by the your leg is attached to your grappling hook. That's pretty sick.
I like the grappling hooks, by the way. So that gives points. It's
time. Oh, me
with
too.
You and telescopes, I'm kind of like that with grappling hooks.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I love grappling hooks, too. I'm with you.
And crossbows, of course.
I laughed because that was clearly a dummy, and I just have... Any shot with a dummy just automatically makes me laugh.
You have good Dundar. You can spot him.
And again, kind of a subdued reaction to this situation. Not like as subdued as earlier, but I'd be screaming.
Ow.
Ow.
I'm all right.
Yeah, see, that's terrible, too. It's just,
Ooh.
High five.
Damn. She gets a good death, man. They give her some time, some screen time. And is this the first water we see in the whole movie?
You're just really building it piece by piece by piece.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you know how much time they spent shooting this last big chase?
I don't remember.
I know they didn't spend as much time shooting the movie as you would think. I think it's a fairly short shoot for what you see on the screen. As far as the chase, though, it had to take a while.
I mean, some of those kind of shots, you can tell they could pick those up easily, but God, so much of it is everybody's really moving.
Oh,
and just those characters are just gone now. That's crazy.
Mm.
Is this the... This might be it, yeah. So that was not how that stunt was supposed to go.
Oh, really?
That was... He was supposed to jump over that, and he broke his leg pretty severely on that stunt, that stuntman did. But they kept it in.
Look at that shot. That was crazy.
Yeah.
These punctuation shots. How do you get that shot?
I mean, that had to be a hard shot to get unless it's just looks that way. They're probably undercranked a little bit there too. On the, here we go. These poor guys. Not these guys, the other guys.
Mm-hmm. The only stitches I've really ever gotten has been when I was cut on a barbed wire fence. And so just seeing anybody around barbed wire makes me get a little queasy.
Mm.
That,
what
like
was
that
guy doing that caused him to... Was he trying to grab one of his arrows? Never could. Again, another really dumb moment from one of these guys.
I don't remember what the camera is actually on for these shots. If it's a helicopter flying low or if it's one of those, I just don't know.
It could have just been that. Clearly they had a working gyro.
Just so.
Copter, yeah, but so. That thing, I can't imagine that gyro mounting with the weight of a camera on it. I
true.
Don't know.
Probably just a helicopter.
Probably a helicopter. I can't even imagine how they knew whether, you know, how many shots that they could hope to get in a day, given how complicated some of these things were.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, it's really one of the great feats of action cinema is this entire sequence. It kind of reminds me of, you know, I recently watched To Live and Die in L.A. again, and I always forget how complicated that chase sequence is.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, how much time did they put into this? And that one even has more, I would say, more like character beats in it, too. So there's a lot of moments that they, where they need to get good reaction shots in the right time.
Yeah, but this thing hardly ever goes back to the same shot. That's what's so amazing.
Oh, more pain.
These cuts are just perfect. Not to bring up my own stuff, but I made a short film called Killing Michael Bay, and it occurs to me that some of my stuff is definitely an homage to this, just mm-hmm. like with the bullets rolling on the hood and stuff. We just missed that terrible shot of those two old poor guys. Mm.
I mean, I'm glad they finally got it over with, to be honest.
Yeah.
They've been having a tough time of it. So we've already revealed the reveal there, but you wouldn't know it because there's too much going on, right?
We actually see
the dirt falling out of the tanker right there from the tanker, but we don't. Why would we notice that? There's way too much going on for us to look at that.
Yeah, it might have been the case that that's the only shot they could use for the story, and well, I don't know. It's starting to happen.
I think he's kind of messing with us.
He's foreshadowing it.
Well, now you don't see it.
It's like there's no way they can win.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, really, talk about the stakes, you know, making it seem just hopeless. They really do a good job in this.
So where's the green screen shot?
Right there.
That?
I think you get another one. Well, those, yeah, and that one, clearly.
Oh, I thought that was just like a process shot.
Well,
like a rear screen, you know,
well, something
live
like that.
Process shot.
The other ones I'm talking, no, I mean, the other ones we saw were, he's clearly like on a rig and they're moving it around with a real sky, but that's, he's not, that's a fake background of some kind. I don't know if it's green screen or not, but or if it's rear projection or whatever.
Probably it's was rear phonier projection.
Than the other ones.
Yeah.
They're running out of light.
Yeah, they sure are.
It looks great.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
That almost looked like, you know, tilt shift miniature-y kind of stuff, those shots from behind.
Get the bullets.
I'll say that the first time I saw this movie, I did not see this coming.
Yeah. They pulled out.
It's like, how did I not see it coming? But I didn't see it coming.
They pull out the sound, right? Like you just hear the wind.
And then you cut to Humongous. So you think Humongous is going to do the next thing. Whatever the next thing is, it's him.
Yeah.
Because he's going to nitro it. He's coming at him hard. So whatever the next thing that they're going to have to deal with, it's him.
Yeah. It's the total John Carpenter trick of creating a misdirect. It's funny how long the moment lasts. You know how they just really stretch it out. Oh.
I think you get the little eye bug there, did you?
I think so.
We got a mouth for sure. I don't know if we got an eye.
Yeah.
Red dirt everywhere.
Yeah. This was the shot.
This is the shot that what?
Well, see how soft it looks? This is the shot where they said they had run out of light and the lens is wide open and they're pushing the film to get anything. You were saying about the 80s?
Oh, it seems like the 80s was the decade of trucks and movies. You know, it starts with Raiders, it goes through this, and then the Terminator, and Near Dark, and...
Well, it really started with BJ and the Bear. BJ and the Bear really brought it in, and then everything's just a copy of that.
Lucky they decided to just go home.
Yeah, they always do that. That's one of them. Well, of course, they don't have anything to fight for anymore. All their bosses are dead. They're probably like, well, let's go do something else.
Well, I think they also saw there was nothing but dirt coming out of the thing.
Yeah. They don't have any revenge aspirations. Right? They're like, what do we want to deal with this for?
Let's probably go. Hit my mom's.
Kicker.
Dissolves. Long dissolves.
I like that they have him carry him that way. It kind of keeps their relationship. It's not a baby carry, like nothing like gentle about the way he carries him. He just like kind of yanks him up and drags him.
Even though it's an 80s movie, this feels like a 70s kind of moment, doesn't it?
A little bit, yeah.
And the gyrocopter's turned into a car. So I think we get two smiles out of Max the whole movie, right?
That moment's earned, though. That's great.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, I like the moment with the old man, too.
And I like the fact that you get a reveal of who's doing the speaking.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of cool.
Oh, me too.
That is just the best shot of him.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing. Todd, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
John, any final thoughts?
Oh, I don't know. Just thinking of, no, not really. Just kind of looking at the credits here to see if there's anything that pops out. But
Mel Gibson is listed Golden with the Youth. Stunt crew, which is nice.
Hey, there's a Norris there, Guy Norris.
Hey, Guy Norris. That's your nom de plume, right? When you go, hey, it's me, it's Guy Norris. There's a Mitch, Mitch Consultancy.
Mr. Consultancy to you. Yeah.
I'm not seeing any Johns here. John. What's going on? John Earn Ingle, please. Certainly. There
John
he is,
Harrell.
John.
There we go.
Harrell flew that helicopter. Yeah, helicopter pilot. So that must have been your helicopter shots. Allison Pickup. There's some funny names in here. Is that her real name? Yeah, I don't have anything else really. Just now I'm just reading names.
Well, thanks everybody for joining us. We hope we've pointed out a couple of things maybe you didn't notice before.
Yeah, if anything, if nothing else, we gave you an excuse to watch the movie again. It's always a good idea.
Yeah.
There's Guy Norris again.
Yeah,
what are you doing?
He was on the stunt team. That's his third. This is his third
and a mechanic.
Credit here.
And now I don't know if we should stop or just keep watching the credits, looking for something funny to say.
Well, we'll just say goodbye to everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
It's a day.
Goodbye.